The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell. Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Today, host Gene Pell talks with Buck Compton, a veteran of E Company, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division in World War II, better known as the Band of Brothers, made famous by the book from Stephen Ambrose and subsequent HBO miniseries. Lieutenant Compton was awarded the Silver Star for his valor in combat as leader of Easy Company's 2nd Platoon. After the war, Compton went on to serve as a California Court of Appeals judge and was the lead prosecutor in the trial of Sirhan Sirhan for the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. He is the author of the recently published Call of Duty, My Life Before, During, and After the Band of Brothers. Gene and Buck begin their conversation talking about Buck's beginnings in Los Angeles.
Buck, let's start back in the beginning and growing up in Los Angeles and what it was like during those years and then eventually how you came to get into the Army. But you knew a lot of interesting people in high school, certainly, and in college at UCLA later. So how did you get into the baseball and football business?
Growing up, I just liked sports. My dad was a sports fan. He used to take me to all the USC football games, and he's a big, he never went to USC, but he was always a big fan of the USC football. And I don't know, I just thought it was a thing to do. You know, you played baseball in the street in front of your house, a game called Over the Line, you know, and playgrounds. I can't say there was any one point where I said, well, I'm going to, you know, want to play sports. It just was sort of a thing to do.
And then you went off to UCLA after high school, and is that where you played baseball with Jackie Robinson?
Yeah.
What was that like?
You know, we weren't close buddies off the field. You know, everybody had their own group of friends, so we weren't that close. But I hung out with him. So we traveled together. When we'd travel up the state or up the coast to play games, you know, we'd travel by train. You know, I remember playing cards with him in one of the cars on the way up, you know, things like that. But at the time, of course, he was not the national figure that he ultimately became, you know, so he was just not one of the guys.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, how did you come to go into the Army then?
Well, in those days, when you went to state school like UCLA, the first 2 years, every male student had to take ROTC for 2 years, you know, take ROTC, and then you could opt to take two more years or four in total and get a commission. And so I opted to take the extra 2 years of ROTC so that when I was through in at the end of the 1942, I was eligible for a commission.
So where were you on December 7th, 1941?
Oh, you mean Pearl Harbor?
Right.
I was living in a little apartment apartment, ground floor apartment with my mother, and I could woke up that morning. We woke up and I heard some neighbors outside talking about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. And of course, you know, when that happened, everybody just assumed that we were going to go into service. You know, we knew we were going to be in a war, and it wasn't a question of whether you were going to go into service or not. It was a question of what branch you were going to opt for and so on.
Well, you then did go in 42, as you said, so you had not yet finished college, though, have you?
Well, I had 4 years, but I didn't have all of the subjects, required subjects in my major, so, you know, matter of fact, I never did get an undergraduate degree from UCLA, because later on I went to law school and got my law degree before I actually had an undergraduate degree from UCLA, so I've got a law degree, but I don't have a B.A. from UCLA.
Well, that's unusual by any standard. So when you did go in, where were you off to as your first duty station?
One of the requirements for getting a commission, in addition to doing the 4 years at UCLA and the ROTC, you had to, at one point during the summer, spend 3 months on active duty at one of the regular military installations. Well, when Pearl Harbor happened, they stopped all that because all of the bases were on, you know, a wartime footing and so on, so that when we got through with our 4 years at UCLA, we still couldn't get a commission because we didn't have the 3 months active duty, so they sent us to Fort Benning to the officer candidate school, and we had to go through the regular OCS, which was sort of a compact version of what we'd already gone through at UCLA. So I didn't get the commission until I'd finished the OCS at Benning.
Well, is that where you got interested in the paratroopers?
Yeah. When I got out of OCS at Benning, I was assigned to a unit, an infantry unit that was stationed right there at Benning, and they were it was 176 infantry. They were doing the demonstration work for the infantry school. Several major leaguers down there, like Ewell Blackwell and Bob Ramazzotti. There was a lot of major leaguers there on and professional ball players on the post, so they had quite a baseball league. And I was, in this regiment I was in, had a baseball team, so I was playing baseball there at Benning for this 176 infantry, and conventional wisdom was, or at least the rumor was, that as long as you were on one of these sports teams, you couldn't get transferred. And I was afraid I was going to miss the war. I thought it was going to be over before I could get there, and I didn't want to spend the whole war just playing baseball. So the only way I could get transferred out of this regiment, because I was a ball player, was to volunteer for either the flight training or parachute troops. The colonel couldn't stop you if you applied for that, for one of those transfers, so I put in for the paratroops just to get into where I thought I would get to go to combat and get away from just spending a war playing baseball.
Well, you got to see plenty of the war before it was over with. Let's jump ahead a little bit and tell me about your jumping into Normandy.
Jumping into Normandy?
Yeah.
We were, you know, we set off from England that night, you know, or early morning. And all I can remember about the Delta, the thing that sticks in my mind was that they'd issued these, what they called, we call them leg bags. They were like a duffel bag on end that you could strap to one of your right leg with a couple of straps around your calf and ankle, and the point being that this bag had about 20 feet of rope that attached to your harness and your chute, and you put a lot of heavy stuff in there, like mortar ammunition and whatever, in this bag, and then when you jumped, when you got out the door, you would release this bag and lower it so that it was hanging below you on a rope, and when you hit the ground, you didn't have all this heavy stuff on it. It kind of reduced the injury factor. But what happened to me, I put everything in that bag, and in addition to the stuff I was supposed to be jumping, I put all my personal belongings and my personal weapon and ammunition, everything in this bag. And when I went out the door, the pilot didn't slow down like he was supposed to. He's supposed to slow down and throttle back to almost stall-out speed, but he was going full bore, and the blast from the propeller was what we call prop blast, was so strong that when my chute came open, this bag flew off my leg without me releasing it, and it's hurtled down and the rope broke, and I never saw the bag again. So when I landed in Normandy, I didn't have a weapon, I didn't have any personal belongings, I didn't have any food, I had nothing but a trench knife on my belt. I wasn't well prepared to do much fighting. I thought we were supposed to go, and as we went along the way, we picked up different guys from different units. And
when we return, Buck recounts his experience during the harshest winter of the war.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. During the second half of this interview, Buck speaks about his unexpected career choice after the war. But first, back to the battlefield of World War II.
Well, when you finally did leave there, I believe after 78 days, you were anticipating some rest, and you didn't get very much, did you?
Sort of felt like the war was about over. They didn't think we were going to probably make another jump, but I was in the middle of coaching a football team that we were getting ready to play a football game against the 502 in Reims on Christmas Day. And it was while we were out practicing one morning at football, and they call came, everybody assembled, and we at noon, and we got our gear together, and they put us on trucks, and that's when they drove us up to Bastogne.
Well, you didn't have a whole lot of gear to get together, as I recall, that you went into the Battle of the Bulge with insufficient winter clothing in one of the worst winters in history.
We went up there with what we had, and it turned out we got caught in a pretty bad winter, but whose fault that was or whether it was anybody's fault, I haven't any idea.
So did you stay all the way then after the siege at Bastogne was lifted? Did you stay then with the 101st all the way to Berchtesgaden?
I spent quite a bit of time in the hospital system and everything. And when I was finally got cleared up with that and was had my orders to go back to rejoin them, by that time they were down in Austria. So I was getting ready to rejoin them when I went into Paris one day. I was stationed at what they call a replacement depot, where they sent you to, where they were shipping you out to the units. And I was wandering around in Paris, and I saw the name of a guy at a military headquarters there at the American Express building, who I'd known from over here in the States. He was baseball player. I'd played against him when he was with the L.A. Angels. I was just walking through his headquarters, and I saw his name up there, and I recognized it, and I went up to visit with him, and he was, at that time, he was a major, I think he was. He was in charge of the athletic program there in Paris, in a command there. And I got to talk to him, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him I was on my way back to the 101st down in Austria, and he said, "Why don't you come here and work with me? You know, we'll work on, you know, on this athletic stuff." And I said, "Well, I got orders to go to rejoin the outfit down in Austria." And he said, "Well, I can take care of that." So he got my orders switched, and I went to work for him there in Paris for a few months in 45, you know. It was the war was over in May there, and I think it was about that time that I joined him in Paris, and I spent those last few months working on an athletic program that we had there in the Paris area, where we had sports facilities for the troops that were there on leave and troops that were stationed around there, and we had swimming pools and running tracks, and got some requisition of a golf course where the soldiers could go play golf if it was. Set up a pretty elaborate athletic program in the area, and then we had a baseball team and a football team.
Well, one of the things you learned when you got back home was the value of persistence when you tried to get into law school.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I'd never dreamed about going to law school, and nobody in my family had ever been a lawyer, and I never crossed my mind. And I had a friend that was a lawyer, and he suggested I go to law school, and I didn't, you know, I never thought about that at all, I couldn't get into the SC because they had so many people trying to get into SC, but took a liking to me, and he let me into law school, primarily because of the fact that I played baseball. Not that I was a very particularly good student.
Well, after law school, you went on to make a very, very successful career as an assistant district attorney, and you had also worked for a while you were going to law school for the Los Angeles Police Department, and then after the stint in the DA's office, you were appointed to the bench, you know, one of the state of California's highest courts. I suppose, having read the book, obviously, that the highlight of your legal career, at least before you went to the bench, was participating in the prosecution of Sirhan Sirhan for the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, that was a historical event, no question about that. You know, the history of the country and everything. Well, I was the chief deputy DA in L.A., which was the number two job in the DA's office.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to be with us this morning and sharing your story with us. We appreciate it very much.
Coming up next on Veterans Chronicles, legendary film star Mickey Rooney.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, now online at radioamerica.org.
Coming up next on Veterans Chronicles, legendary American film actor and entertainer Mickey Rooney joins us to share his World War II experiences as he toured with troops on the front lines, earning him a Bronze Star. Jan, his wife, also joins us. The American Veterans Center and Gene Pell are proud to present his story.
Let's start with World War II. And,
thank God it's finished.
Well, you played a very active role, certainly after 1944. How did you happen to go in? You thought you had been turned down.
Oh, I was there before 1944.
Right, but when you first were called up...
I was there from 42 to 44.
Okay. But when you were first called up, there was some blood pressure problem, and they said you couldn't come in?
No, they were trying to fix it so I wouldn't. Somebody, and I won't mention who it was, and I said, no, you're never going to do that. I wouldn't let you do that. And I told my mother about it. She said, you wouldn't be a son of mine if you did that. And I said, oh, I couldn't live with myself. So anyway, I was in the Army, and we were sent to Fort Riley, Kansas for basic training because they put me in the cavalry. And we fed the mules and the horses every morning, and we were put in barracks, and the fellas were very, very nice. They didn't get smart alecky towards me or this and that.
Well, I understand you had a pretty good fist fight with one of them at one point.
Yes, but after that was over, they knew that I'd stand up. The fact is that the stories I could tell you would be here for 3 days about my association in the Army.
Well, that's what we're going to hear more of. I know you early on qualified as an expert marksman.
Yes,
and
I did.
You made sergeant and squad leader pretty good.
Yes,
early.
I did. Yes, I did. I was a sergeant when I came out, and I have my European theater thing and my good conduct and of course,
you behaved?
And
I can't believe it.
Seven clusters
right
on my European theater for seven things that I was in.
Well, he was always such a great athlete, so the sharpshooter, is that what it was for, dear?
Yes, it was.
That doesn't surprise
people,
me.
There are millions of people that qualified for that, but the fact is that I was very proud. The fact is that before I went into the Army, and I had been doing pictures like the Andy Hardy series, which were American. Lewis Stone and
more
family.
Up today.
I mean, we said grace before dinner, and we thanked everybody that we had our family together.
Always had a good moral to those stories.
Yes,
didn't
I
they?
Made 19 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And very proud because they were family pictures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've made 360 motion pictures, more than anybody in the business.
Right.
And I made some good ones and bad ones. I made some that were so bad they were released, they escaped.
Well, I think you're going to be in the Guinness Book of Records for all your...
Yes,
I believe
yes, and I'm proud of The Black Stallion and Bridges of Tokari.
National Velvet.
And,
yes, National Velvet.
National Velvet with Elizabeth Taylor. And then, of course...
Boys Town.
Boys Town.
Spencer Tracy.
Because that's real.
Mm-hmm.
As we speak on this, It was called Boys and Girls Town, and Jan and I do work for Boys.
We have for many years. Such
Boys
a
Town,
good, wonderful
because
cause.
It's so. Because I learned also, being the that 45 graduates of Boys Town or 50 that were in the service. Some of them
and
became governors.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them became, and we lost about 19 of them.
Just recently, yeah.
In the war.
Different war, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And in what's going on. And it's...
But the Boys Town members have been fighting for their wonderful country. And
mm-hmm. Yes, they have.
Back and
Father Flanagan is real. I mean, yes. He came from Ireland. Jan and I visited the place mm-hmm. where he was
His
born.
His birthplace in Ireland mm-hmm. just recently.
And then we did our show in Dublin.
Yes, we did.
Well, I'm going to come back to your two-person show in a bit. But
Mickey Rooney, along with other entertainers, ventured into the front lines to perform what was known as Jeep Show for the troops and distinguished itself as being dangerously close to battle.
Right. Let's go with the Army here for
yes,
a minute.
Yes, I know. Oh,
because when you were in Europe,
yes.
There's a misconception, I think, generally in the public, that the entertainers were there and behind the line.
That was USO.
Right.
That was not.
Oh, no. Mickey went on to do Jeep Show.
There was even talk that they would put in Washington, D.C., sort of a monument that you could go in and see the pictures mm-hmm. of the fellas and where we were.
Yeah.
And 52 of them, Mario Peroni and Bob Priester were with my group. And we do shows at any time we could. We couldn't sleep.
Well, you put yourself in harm's way,
where were we
going to
sleep?
You?
Where were we going to take a shower? How would keep ourselves hygienically? And neither could the veterans. And we do shows at 2 o'clock in the morning before they jumped off.
Tell well, you were also near the front lines.
Yes, we were in the front lines.
Exactly.
Right.
That's why I got that's why I was recommended my Bronze Star. We were doing a show at the time when we were being bombed.
That's.
And I said, fellas, stand your line. We can do it. Stay there. Stay there. We'll entertain. Don't worry. Your mother and father and the Lord is thinking about you.
Oh.
And, They did laugh and this and that, and sometimes we'd get too close and we'd have to stop the show. And on one occasion, which I was very proud of, the General Patton was with some people in his Jeep. And he says, I want to find out who that group is. I'm going to recommend Mickey Rooney for the Bronze Star.
Oh.
And so he recommended for me, and the General Rail Splitters gave it to me on behalf of him.
Mm-hmm.
Mickey will tell us about his visit with an amputee during the war and their unplanned reunion many years later.
I want to ask you about one incident, because in addition to family, and I couldn't agree with you more, but kindness to others is a great virtue.
Respect and consideration goes a long way.
And consideration.
Well
said.
An example is when you were visiting a hospital and an amputee said you stopped to talk to him.
Yes.
And he was
said,
afraid that his girlfriend was going to give her up.
He was crying.
Right.
And I said to him, and we were in a schoolhouse that had been transported into an operating room. And I said, what's the matter, son? And he was about as old or maybe a year younger than I was at the time.
You called him son.
And then I said, what's the matter, my young friend? He said, you know what they're going to do to me? I said, no, I know they're going to take care of you. He said, they're going to take off my leg. And we both stood for a moment and he said, what am I going to do? I said, well, don't you know? Herbert Marshall, who's in motion pictures, has a fake leg, and he became one of the best actors in the world. He says, he did? I said, you bet he did. And you can do anything you want if you set your heart to it.
But you also told him not to worry about whether his girl was going to be there when he got home.
She'll be there. I said, don't worry. for fellas who are listening to this who lose their arms or their fingers or legs, remember, your loved ones will always be there for you.
Now, what happened a few years later when you were in the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco?
I don't remember that.
When somebody called you over to his table.
And he said,
it's the same guy.
Hi, Mick. And I said, hi. He says, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no. He says, I'm the fellow that they cut their leg off. That you were with me. I said, you are. Did you let it bother you? He says, no. He says, I'm married to the girl.
We have children, what a lovely story.
I'm an executive.
Oh, give such hope.
I'm taking care
of it. That is a wonderful story.
Yes, it is, and it's a true story.
But because you were so close to the enemy, you saw a lot of carnage and a lot of death.
I certainly did, unfortunately, and I was at Buchenwald and a few other places and it was a tragic thing to see. It was tragic. I was at Hitler's lair. We walked in there, and there were about 60 of us, and I went into his office there, and I got some stationery, HA, and
A,
this and that.
H, yes.
So, and I found some Leica cameras and this and that, and I packed them in a box and everything else to send home. They never got home.
Oh, really?
No, the ship was sunk.
Oh.
Yeah, but you know, I was in the White House many times. I was there when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was there, and of course they had ramps in the White House at that time.
Well, we were just...
He asked me to come.
Yes.
He asked me to come.
But we were just with...
So Les Peterson took me to Washington, and we took a train. There were no planes at that time. Mm-hmm. And I walked in, and he says, one of the men said, Mr. Rooney, the president's waiting for you. I said, thank you.
Isn't that wonderful?
And this is before I had my Bronze Star, which I'd have worn. But I think I was about 14, 15, and I'll tell them that later.
Yeah.
And I was in the White House, and I met Mr. Roosevelt, and he said, sit down, Ricky. And I said, thank you, Mr. President. He said, you know, I'm a big fan. I said, thank you. I said, he says, I've seen the Andy Hardy pictures. And they're wonderful. General MacArthur takes them with him wherever he goes. They were about America. And he said, can I tell you a story? He said, yes. He said, you see that drape over there? I said, yes. He said, I was sitting here one night, and the drapes started to move. I said, what'd you do? Did you get excited? He said, no. I said, who's there? And out behind the drape came a dirty-faced little fellow about 7 years old. He says, how long have you been there? The president said. He said, I don't know, about a week or 10 days. He says, well, your mother must have missed you terribly. Do you know where you live? He says, of course. He says, have you eaten for a long time? So he pressed a button. He says, send my friend Johnny some, what do you like, ham and cheese or white bread, whatever you want, a glass of milk. He says, I'd love it. He says, with mustard? He says, yes, Mr. President. So he sent them, and of course some FBI men came in and said, what's it? He says, it's all right. I want you to meet my friend. This is Johnny. They said, hi, Johnny. And this is Mickey Rooney. I said, how do you do, sir? He said, eat your sandwich, and these men will take you home. You give them the address. Yes, I will. Thanks. Well, and I left, too. I said, gee, what a kind, considerate, beautiful man you are, Mr. President. Thank you for asking me. He says, thank you for coming, Mickey. And keep making those pictures that will entertain people.
Is that right?
Well, I was in the radio in after the war for a few weeks in Regensburg, mm-hmm. Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I entertained with, and after the war, I entertained Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, and De Gaulle at the Madeleine Theater mm-hmm. in Paris.
I know it.
Did you know about that?
No, but I know the Madeleine.
Yes.
So, are you still, or have you kept ties to the armed services in one way
well,
or
we
another?
We try and do as much as we can, Jan and I, when they ask us for the USO.
Well, let me ask you this in the closing. We have a motto here at this organization. We call it from the greatest to the latest, i.e. the greatest generation to today's young men and women.
Yes.
Warriors.
Yes.
In Iraq, Afghanistan, and all over
all
the world.
The world
for that,
that
matter.
Matter.
Right.
Sure.
What do you take from your experience in the military that you would pass on to this generation today, which is doing such a marvelous job for
Yes,
it?
They are. Jan and I, my wife Jan and I, pray every day for our soldiers and our women.
For their safety.
For their safety.
For their health.
Whether it be in Iraq.
For their families.
Or whether it be in Afghanistan or where it is.
That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pellcom Communications.